Good to see such a good turnout. This is the one of the monthly colloquium series of the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute, which is a mouthful. We just call it IBRI for short, that we have regularly a biblical seminary on a monthly basis, as I just said. We welcome you this evening. I think we have a real treat in store. Very pleased to have with us Dr. Stanley Grenz, who is Professor of Theology and Ethics at Carey Regent College in Vancouver, British Columbia. Dr. Grenz has been very active in, he's done a lot of things. He's got his doctorate in theology from the University of Munich, spent time as a pastor, started a couple of different seminaries, and he's written a number of books. He is especially concerned to help evangelicals understand this cultural shift that we are in the midst of, that we talk about as postmodernity, and his concern is not only to help us to understand it, but help us as evangelicals to think about how we can interact with it in a fruitful way for the sake of the gospel. I'll just mention that we have a number of his recent books available in the bookstore, which probably isn't open tonight, but if you're around, it is open. It is open now. Well, in any case, they're available. If you can't get them tonight, you come back, and they will be around. They're very useful. I particularly call your attention to a volume entitled Created for Community, which is a distillation of his one-volume systematic theology entitled Theology for the Community of God, and also a recent publication from Erdmans entitled A Primer on Postmodernism. So these will be helpful things if you want to explore this further. This lecture is also being taped, so if you would like a copy, that is available through the bookstore. You can see Doc Newman. Without further ado, then, I'd like to introduce to you Dr. Stanley Grenz and welcome you to us.
Good evening, everyone. I am honored by your presence, the fact that you would take a beautiful Monday evening in Philadelphia and come out to hear me talk is, for me, a deep honor. And I hope that when I am finished, you will believe that it had been worth your while to do so. It's good to be in Philadelphia. I look forward to this opportunity to be with you. So thank you very much for it. I've entitled my lecture this evening, actually, The Gospel and the Star Trek Generation. But allow me, first of all, to read several verses of Scripture from Romans chapter 10. Everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But how can they call on the one they've not believed in? And how can they believe in the one of whom they have not heard? And how can they hear without someone preaching to them? And how can they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news. Reminds me that my father was a Baptist pastor for 30 years before his death at the age of 56. And when I was a teenager in Greeley, Colorado, growing up in the church there was a boy in the congregation who went home from Sunday school one day, said to his mother, "Does Pastor Grenz have beautiful feet?" And his mother said, "Well, I don't know. Why do you ask?" "Well, we read in Sunday school this morning, how beautiful are the feet of those who bring good news." So may it be, sisters and brothers, that each of us has beautiful feet. The camera focuses on a futuristic spacecraft against the background of distant galaxies. The narrator's voice proudly recites the guiding dictum, the John 3:16 of Trekkies. Say it with me. Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations. Altogether in the chorus, to boldly go where no one has gone before. With these words begins another episode of the obviously popular television series Star Trek and its second installment, Star Trek: The Next Generation. Now, as you Trekkies know, that in many ways, The Next Generation, the second series, was simply an updated version of the earlier Star Trek, placed in a future era after the resolution of some of the galactic political difficulties that plagued the universe of the previous space voyagers. Yet, as Jean-Luc Picard's new breed of explorers took over the command of the redesigned Enterprise from Captain Kirk's crew, the creators of the series discovered that the world of their audience was in the midst of a far-reaching cultural shift. Modernity was giving birth to post-modernity. The Next Generation became both a reflection and a molder of the worldview of the emerging generation, the generation of my 17-year-old son, Joel. So let's look at this postmodern Star Trek generation. Whatever else it might be, as the name suggests, postmodern is the quest to move beyond the modern. It is a rejection of the modern mindset launched under the conditions of modernity. The stage for the birth of the modern era, which we want to look at first, was set in the Renaissance, which elevated humankind to the center of reality. Building on the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, roughly the 17th and 18th centuries, created the individual self and made the self the center of the world. Instrumental in this development were the intellectual innovations of two prominent thinkers, a philosopher and a scientist. The philosopher was René Descartes. Now, it's spelled like Descartes, but it's pronounced Descartes, just like Des Moines is pronounced Des Moines. Descartes introduced doubt as the first principle of philosophical inquiry. Why do your children doubt everything you say? Blame it on Descartes. Doubting everything, however, led Descartes to conclude that there was one thing he could not doubt, namely the existence of the one who was doubting. And thus he concluded that the thinking self is the first truth which doubt could not deny, hence his reappropriation of Augustine's dictum cogito ergo sum, or I think, therefore I am. In so doing, Descartes defined human nature as a thinking substance and the human person as an autonomous, rational subject. The British physicist Sir Isaac Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N, in turn, pictured the physical world as a machine governed by laws of regularity which could be discerned by the human mind. The modern human, therefore, became Descartes' autonomous, rational mind encountering Newton's mechanistic world, which was governed, it was so believed, according to laws that could be discerned through human reason. The postulates of the thinking self and the mechanistic universe opened the way for the explosion of knowledge that came on the heels of the Enlightenment. The goal of the human intellectual quest was that of unlocking the secrets of the universe. And the purpose of this quest was to master nature for human benefit and thereby create a better world for human habitation. This quest led to the technological society, characteristic of the 20th century.
Now, lying at the intellectual foundation of the Enlightenment project are certain assumptions. Philosophers call them epistemological assumptions. Assumptions about the nature of human knowledge. Most of us accept these without question, if we were raised in the modern era. Namely, we accept without question that knowledge is certain, objective, and good. First, we assume that knowledge is certain. What we know for sure. This assumption sets us in search for universal truth in the form of correct statements or propositions. Truth is what can be stated in the form of assertions, specifically assertions which ascribe measurable properties to aspects of reality, which we place under the scrutiny of human reason. Editorial comment. I came here from a CT Institute, a Christianity Today Institute, in which we were talking about global stewardship. At one point in this discussion that we had with 40 academic people from all around the country, somebody introduced technology. They gave a keyboard, a keypad, to each one of us, and we were to answer yes or no to a list of questions. And the computer would tabulate our scores and put them up in the form of graphs indicating what percentage of male and female answered each question yes and no, what percentage of those 35 and under, and on and on and on and on and on. You see. What was happening here, right before our very eyes, was an attempt to reduce our entire discussion to measurable quantities, reduce it all to mathematics, and put it up in the form of a graph. Now, friends, how can you reduce global stewardship to a graph of what people 25 years to 35 years think over against what those 45 to 55 think? See? Well, that's indicative of the modern mentality. Reduce everything to mathematics, what can be measurable, and then make your assertions based on all of that. Second, we moderns assume that knowledge is objective. What could be more objective than a keypad and a graph, you see? What we know is out there just waiting for us to discover it. Truth, then, becomes the correspondence of our assertions with reality as it is in itself, so we believe. Thus, we say, snow is white because we believe that we have discovered objectively factual knowledge about snow as it really is. It's white. The assumption that knowledge is objective, in turn, sets us on a quest for a dispassionate truth, gained as we supposedly stand apart from the world and peer at it. We believe that we can view the world, as it were, from a vantage point outside the flux of history, and this leads us then, in turn, to idolize the specialist, the supposedly neutral observer who has gained expertise in a limited field of endeavor, that proverbial person who knows more and more about less and less. Hence, modern people elevate the PhD and look to the MD for the solution to all of their ills. Third, we moderns assume that knowledge is inherently good. After all, it's better to know than not to know. And the worst thing we want to be is considered to be ignorant. This belief nurtures an unflinching optimism about the future when we view society as a whole. Progress, we believe, is inevitable because science, coupled with the power of education, will eventually not only free us from our vulnerability to nature, but also lift us out of the ignorance that lies at the roots of all social problems. Think about, you know, the Great Society. Educate people, throw enough dollars at it, and there's no problem that we can't solve. That's the modern mentality. And because knowledge is good, we add, scientific discovery is a self-evident, unchallengeable right, a charter of human freedom. As a result, we are suspect as a society of all beliefs that seem to curtail autonomy, or to be based on some external authority beyond reason. And the modern ideal is the self-made man, gender specificity by design. The purely rational human, generally male person, who can cut through ignorance and superstition and root to providing solutions to seemingly unsolvable problems. Like modern fiction in general, the original Star Trek series encapsulated many aspects of the Enlightenment project and of late modernity. The crew of the Enterprise, way back in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, as you recall, the crew of the Enterprise included persons of various nationalities working together for the common benefit of humankind. Remember, there was an American, and obviously a Russian, obviously someone from Asia, you know, in this crew together. Very few women, you might recall. And the message there was obvious. It was the Cold War era, keep in mind. The message was, look, in the end, we are all human. As humans, we must overcome our differences, even our ideological differences, and join forces in order to complete our human mandate, which the writers, being good modernists, believed was the quest for certain objective knowledge of the entire universe, of which space looms as the final frontier. One hero of the old Star Trek was Spock. Although he was the only crew member who came from another planet, you recall he was part human, part Vulcan, his non-humanness actually served as a transcendent human ideal. Spock was the ideal Enlightenment man, completely rational and without emotion, or always having these emotions in check. Repeatedly, his dispassionate rationality provided the calculative key necessary to solve the problems encountered by the crew. Spock was this person who could provide the rationality, the calculative key necessary to solve the problem, because for the writers of Star Trek, the original Star Trek, our problems, in the end, are rational, and therefore can be solved by the application of rationality. Now, you people who've never watched Star Trek, you might remember the adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Holmes is the same person as Spock. See? Holmes is this 19th century figure, it's the height of the modernity, who has these incredible powers of observation and reason that all humans have, but haven't developed them to the extent that he has. And Holmes was able to take what on the surface appeared to be this incredible mystery, and by applying his powers of observation and reason, was able to solve the mystery so that, in the end, it all appeared to be elementary, my dear Watson. Well, that is the Enlightenment and the old modern understanding. I'd like us to take a peek at a little clip from the original Star Trek and see how these themes come to bear in this situation. It comes at the very end of an episode. It's called Devil in the Dark. There are some miners off on a different planet whose task was to mine Phrygium. But they're discovering that some of their crew members are being killed. And they determine that there is a life form on this planet that's killing their crew members. And so they want, of course, to kill the life form before they all die. And notice in this episode how at the end now you get rationality, Spock. You get medical science, Bones the doctor, and incredibly powerful leadership, okay, the captain, Kirk, combining under the focus of rationality to dispel ignorance
which, because of ignorance, leads to emotion, which in turn leads to violence. This is a social commentary of the day.
Years, the entire race dies, all but one, like this one. But the eggs live. She cares for them, protects them. And when they hatch, she is the mother to them, thousands of them. This creature here is the mother of her race, larger, intelligent, peaceful, fine. Get no objection to sharing this planet with you. Have you broken into her nursery instead of destroying her eggs? And she fought back in the only way she knew how, as any mother would fight. But her children aren't thinking. They didn't know how good it would be. You mean if these eggs hatch, to be thousands of those things crawling around down here? This is where they live. They digest, grow, they tell them, they nourish.
And they are the most inoffensive of creatures. They harbor ill will toward no one.
Oh, look, we have her gym to deliver. Yes, I know. Here's your circulating pump. You complain this planet is a mineralogical treasure house if you have the equipment to get it. The hoarder moves through rock the way we move through air, and it leaves tunnel. The greatest natural miners in the universe. Make breach and motors with envy. They tunnel. You collect and process. And your process operation would be 1,000 times more profitable. Sounds all right if it'll work.
Except for one thing. The boy is very important. It may die.
It won't die. By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can endure a rainy day.
How did I cure it? Well, I had the ship being done 100 pounds of that thermal concrete, you know, the kind we use to build emergency shelters out on, mostly silicone. So I just crawled it into the womb.
It'll act like a bandage until it heals. Take a look.
It is new.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to ask you to get in touch with her. Tell her our proposition. She and her children can do all the tunneling they want. Our people will remove the minerals. And inside, will you put her alone? We should go for it.
It seems logical, Kevin. The Horda has a very logical mind. And after close association with humans, I find that curiously refreshing.
Okay. Well, was that obvious enough? How all that works together, you know, just the ignorance of the crew you bring. You solve the mystery because they didn't know what these things were. You find out they're eggs. It all logically fits together. You tell them about it. You dispel the violence, the emotion, and it sounds logical. You create a win-win situation, they say, and it all makes sense. It all fits together. And we can get on with the modern project. Well, the modern project, although it was continuously under attack from the fringes, nevertheless reigned in Western society until 1970. The reaction to modernity that was all fermenting under the scenes, behind the scenes, came to the fore in a full-scale frontal assault in the 70s. A frontal assault that began intellectually, in any case, in the university, in the English department of all places, and moved to the philosophical department after that. The English department, it came to the fore in a program called Deconstruction.
Now, deconstruction worked off the prior movement of structuralism. The structuralists said that people write texts in order to help them make sense out of the world, and that some structuralists went so far as to say that all of these texts have a similar structure, even one basic structure that permeates all the texts and can be mined from the texts themselves. And that's then what their literary criticism is all about, was to discover that. The post-structuralists denied that final idea, that final tenet, that there was this universal structure present in the texts. In fact, the post-structuralists, or deconstructionists, said that there is no meaning inherent in the text itself. Text has no meaning. But rather, what the deconstructionists said is that meaning is created through the interaction between the reader and the text. So to take an example, there is no inherent meaning in Moby Dick, the novel Moby Dick. But rather, what happens is that as you enter into a relationship with Moby Dick, as you read it, meaning emerges. He said, well, you can understand what that would do with biblical exegesis, but then that's a whole other question. There may be then as many meanings of a text as there are readers or even readings. Because you read the text 10 years from now, and it's different. Now, the postmodern philosophers picked up on the theories of the literary deconstructionists and applied them to the world as a whole. Just as the meaning of a text is dependent on the reader, so also reality can be read differently depending on the perspectives of the knowing selves that encounter reality. This means that there is no one meaning of the world. Or to use the language of some of the philosophers like Jacques Derrida, there's no transcendent center to the reality, to reality as a whole. Because nothing transcendent inheres in reality. What emerges in the knowing process in our encounter with the world is merely the perspective of the self, the reader, who interprets reality. Hence, these philosophical thinkers have jettisoned the classic conception of truth as the mind, or even language, being a mirror of nature. That's Richard Rorty's famous book about the mind and the mirror of nature. What truth, then, is simply pragmatic. Truth is what works. In the end, the postmodern realm becomes an arena of dueling texts. That is, your interpretation versus my interpretation. Now, these philosophical ideas that I've just presented are a central aspect, actually, of a much larger intellectual shift, which is reflected in various aspects of contemporary Western culture. And this shift, which is present in the academy as well as in pop culture today, this shift questions the central assumptions of the Enlightenment that I mentioned earlier. Let's go back to those three presuppositions about the nature of knowledge and reintroduce them in reverse order. First, in the postmodern world, people are no longer convinced that knowledge is inherently good. In eschewing the Enlightenment myth of inevitable progress, postmoderns replace the utopian optimism of the 19th century with a gnawing and even apocalyptic pessimism. It is simply not the case, they tell us, that each and every day, in each and every way, we're getting better and better. For the first time in many years, members of the emerging generation do not share the conviction of their parents that we will solve the enormous problems of this planet. Nor are they at all hopeful that their economic situation will surpass that of their parents. My kids don't believe that they'll make as much money as I'm making, as meager as my salary is. In fact, it's interesting to note that my son Joel, 17, at age 15, said, "When I finish my education, there will not be a job for me." So what did he do? He started his own company. I never would have thought of doing that at age 15. I was more interested in getting my first job in the grocery store. Okay? The difference in Esau's ethos. Now, if we had an overhead projector, I would show you this piece from Doonesbury, but I'll just read it to you in the interest of time. This is the president of the university campus, of the university, delivering the president's remarks to the graduating class at commencement. And finally, to parents here today, a bit of advice. Suffer your children gladly. If they do not make their way out into the world immediately, it is because the world has become such a forbidding place in these times. Never has a class graduated into such an uncertain and bleak economic environment. How bleak? Well, this year only a single company recruited on campus, down from two last year. We are, of course, deeply grateful to the remaining employer for its commitment to our graduates. But losing McDonald's was a blow. Or this one, this you'll have to excuse the language. This isn't language I would use, but it's the language of Generation X. After the commencement exercises are over, two of the graduates are leaning up against a brick wall and thinking together. The first says to the other, "When you get right down to it, the future sucks, doesn't it, man?" "Totally," says his friend. "Especially for someone in my position. You want to know what my future looks like? I've got a $7 an hour job and over $60,000 in student loans." Dead silence. His friend says, "You're not waiting for me to do the math on that, are you, man?" His friend says, "Try 50 years old, maybe older." See? You hear the cry in that. The pathos of the emerging generation. I read the comics and watch Star Trek professionally. Members of the emerging adult generation also know that life on the earth is fragile, and the continued existence of humankind, they believe, is dependent on a new attitude, which replaces the image of conquest with that of cooperation. This new emphasis on holism, as it's called, is related to the postmodern rejection of the second Enlightenment assumption, namely that truth is certain and hence purely rational. Postmoderns realize that truth can also be non-rational. By refusing to limit truth to its rational dimension, the postmodern mind dethrones the human intellect as the arbiter of truth. Because truth is not limited to what the intellect can comprehend, there are other ways of knowing today, including through the emotions and the intuition. Have you heard the latest? We no longer measure IQ, but EQ. Did you read that article in Time magazine recently? That they say now that a better gauge of what your life will be like, your probable success in business, is not your IQ, but your emotional quotient. Emotions is a new way of knowing. In the same way, the postmodern mind no longer accepts the third Enlightenment belief, namely that knowledge is objective. Indeed, the postmodern model of the world does not see the universe as mechanistic and dualistic. The world is not simply an objective given, which we can discover and know. Instead, it's historical, it's relational, it's participatory. In rejecting the modern assumption of the objectivity of knowledge, the postmodern mind likewise dismisses the Enlightenment ideal of the dispassionate, autonomous knower, Knowledge is not simply out there, waiting to be discovered by specialists who bring their rational talents to the givenness of the world at all. Actually, the postmodern worldview operates with a more social as opposed to individualistic understanding of truth. Not only the specific truths we accept, but even our understanding of truth itself, they say, is a function of the community, the society in which we participate. This, in turn, leads to a new conception of the relativity of truth. The old relativism is passé. Not only is there no universal truth, I mean, that's old hat. More specifically and significantly, truth is relative to the community or social group in which we participate. Truth is what fits within a specific community. Truth consists in the ground rules that facilitate the well-being of the group in which one participates. The postmodern perspective is reflected in the second Star Trek series, Star Trek: The Next Generation. The humans who make up the crew of the original Enterprise are now joined by humanoid life forms from other parts of the universe. This change represents the broader universality of postmodernity. You see, humankind, according to the authors of The Next Generation, humankind is not capable of completing the older mandate alone. In fact, the burden of the quest doesn't even fall to humans alone. The crew of the Enterprise now symbolizes the new ecology, humankind in partnership with the universe. Their mission is no longer to boldly go where no man has gone before, but where no one has gone before. And that one is not merely inclusive language, it's ecologically inclusive language. In Star Trek: The Next Generation, Data replaces Spock. In fact, Data, in a sense, is Spock, the fully rational thinker, capable of superhuman intellectual feats. But despite his seemingly perfect intellect, Data is not the transcendent human ideal Spock embodies, but rather he's an android, a subhuman machine, a computer. His desire is not only to understand what it means to be human, but also to become human. But he lacks certain necessary aspects of humanness. In the various episodes of The Next Generation, Data learns what these aspects are and even begins to develop some of them. And what are they? A sense of humor, emotion, the ability to dream, and even the experience of intimacy, none of which would have been suggested in the Enlightenment. Although Data often provides valuable assistance in dealing with problems, he's only one of several who contribute to finding solutions. In addition to this master of rationality, the Enterprise crew includes persons skilled in the affective and intuitive dimensions of human life as well. Especially prominent is Counselor Deanna Troi, a woman gifted with the ability to perceive the hidden feelings of others. The new voyages of the Enterprise lead its variegated crew into a postmodern universe. In this new world, time is no longer simply linear. Appearance is not necessarily reality. And the rational is not always to be trusted. In contrast to the older series, which in typical modern fashion generally ignores questions of God and religious belief because they're irrelevant, the postmodern world of Star Trek, The Next Generation, includes the supernatural. One obvious example, of course, is the strange character Q. Yet its picture of the divine is not simply that of traditional Christian theology. Q possesses classical attributes of divine power, such as omniscience, but he displays both benevolence and a bent toward cynicism and even self-gratification. Interestingly, the supernatural gives way to spirituality in the subsequent series, Deep Space Nine, and more recently, in Voyager. Voyager, by the way, now the spaceship is lost in space, trying to find its way home. How far we've come from to boldly go to find our way back is the problem. Now, if technology cooperates, let's, I think, see how these ideas, including the critique of human progress and rationality, were expressed in the very opening scene from the first Next Generation episode, originally aired in the fall of 1987. We pick up the Enterprise, I hope, on her maiden voyage.
Our destination is planet Denim 4, beyond which lies the great unexplored mass of the galaxy.
Right.
While I'm becoming better acquainted with my new command,
okay,
this galaxy class USS Enterprise. I'm still somewhat in awe of its size and complexity. As for my crew, we are short in several key positions, most notably a first officer. But I'm informed that a highly experienced man, one Commander William Riker, will be waiting to join the ship at our Denet 4 destination.
You will agree, Data, that Starfleet's orders are difficult.
Difficult? Simply solve the mystery of Park One Station.
As simple as that.
Park One Station. Even the name sounds mysterious.
It's hardly simple, Data. Negotiate a friendly agreement. Starfleet use the base while at the same time snoop around, finding out how and why a life form there should be.
Inquiry.
To seek covertly. To go stealthily. To slip. Slip to death. Glide. Creep. Stop. Pussy. Gun. Yes. Shoot.
I'm sensing a powerful mind.
It registers a solid, Captain.
Or an incredibly powerful force field. But if we collide with either, it could be very...
Stop that damn noise! Cover yellow line.
Infiltrated the galaxy too far already. Thou art directed to return to thine own solar system immediately.
That's quite a directive. Would you mind identifying what you are?
Call ourselves Q. Well, thou mayst call it that. It's all much the same thing. I present myself to thee as a fellowship captain, that thou mayst better understand me. Go back whence thou camest. Stay where thou art.
He would not have injured you. You recognize this? A stun setting?
Knowing you may have found out, Captain, wouldst thou be captured helpless by? Now go back. But I shall most certainly die.
Well, the contrast is blatantly obvious, isn't it? Knowing humans as thou dost, wouldst thou be captured helpless by them? Now go back, or thou shalt surely die. And if you've seen the episode, you know that the Q then put humankind on trial. They're charged of being a savage and barbarous race. Well, now, let's look at the Christian gospel and this postmodern ethos. In the 20th century, evangelical Christians attempted to respond to the challenge posed by the worldview of late modernity. To a culture which glorifies reason and deifies science, we spoke about a faith that is rational and reasonable. We sought to demonstrate the credibility of the Christian faith by bolstering the gospel with a rational apologetic, which included intellectual proofs, the existence of God, the trustworthiness of the Bible, historicity of Jesus' resurrection. And we did well in developing a vision of the Christian faith for the old Star Trek society. We're now moving into a new context, it seems. The Western world, from pop culture to academia, seems to be abandoning, to some extent, the Enlightenment principles, which form the solid bedrock of modernity. The postmodern ethos is especially influential among younger adults who take for granted the information age, MTV, 54-channel programming, and the like. This generation has been nurtured in a context shaped less by commitment to the modern ethos embodied in the old Star Trek than by the postmodern vision represented in Star Trek The Next Generation and subsequent episodes and metamorphoses of that. This generation is less impressed than we were with linear thinking, rational argumentation, final answers to their questions. They live in a complex and complicated world, a world that the human mind, they believe, simply cannot fathom. The shift from the familiar territory of modernity to the uncharted terrain of postmodernity has grave implications for us as we seek to live as Christ's disciples and proclaim the gospel in the new context. If we are to communicate the gospel to a postmodern culture, then we must learn to evaluate the philosophical mood of the day. Our evaluation of postmodernism ought to lead us to conclude that as Christians, we cannot help but be sympathetic to some of the basic aspects of its rejection of the Enlightenment assumptions about human knowledge. Like the postmoderns, we also deny that the rational scientific method is the sole arbiter of truth. We affirm that certain aspects of truth may lie beyond reason and cannot be fathomed by reason. As the old Pietist poetically declared, the heart has reasons which the head cannot understand. Indeed, biblical Christians take a cautious stance toward human reason. We know that because of the fall, sin can blind the human mind. And we realize that following the intellect can sometimes lead us away from God and truth. There is a way that seems right to mankind, but the end thereof is destruction. Similarly, together with postmoderns, we know that the observer cannot simply stand outside the historical process in an attempt to gain universal, culturally neutral knowledge as unconditioned specialists. In fact, postmodern philosophers are actually echoing Augustine when they assert that our personal convictions and commitments not only color our search for knowledge, they actually also facilitate the process of understanding. I believe in order that I may understand, was the dictum from Augustine to Anselm. Indeed, the Christian intellectual endeavor has always been faith seeking understanding. And did not Paul allude to the same point when he declared that the unspiritual person cannot discern spiritual truth? 1 Corinthians 2:14. Likewise, events of the 20th century bear poignant witness that despite its benefits, the knowledge explosion cannot inaugurate a humanly constructed utopia. Technological advances bring not only the possibility of good, but also the potential for evil. An obvious example is the splitting of the atom in the 1940s. This discovery opened the door to a nuclear Armageddon and a whole new type of non-disposable waste. We may not have seen Jurassic Park to wonder what evil may lurk behind the mapping of the human genetic structure, despite whatever promise it holds to improve life on this planet. The Christian understanding of our human situation provides the foundation for this critique of the Enlightenment assumption of the inherent goodness of knowledge. The human problem, we believe, is not merely ignorance. Humans also suffer from a misdirected will. We must not only be saved from our ignorance, we require a renewal and redirection of the heart. Now, despite these affinities, as Christians, we cannot overlook a glaring problem with the postmodern ethos. The tragedy of the postmodern situation is the loss of belief that any final criterion exists by which we can evaluate the various interpretations of reality that compete in the contemporary realm. In this situation, all human interpretations, including the Christian interpretation, are equally valid, because they are all equally invalid. In fact, as adjectives describing interpretations, valid and invalid become meaningless today. At best, we can judge these interpretations only according to pragmatic standards, they tell us. What is true is simply what works. Our commitment to the God revealed in Christ demands that we stand squarely against this dimension of postmodernism, namely its loss of a center. As biblical Christians, we believe that there is a unity to reality. Postmoderns deny that there are any overarching, unifying storylines that bring the diverse human communities into a single whole. There is no story of the human community, the history of humankind, only a multitude of stories of human communities, they tell us. We, in contrast, firmly believe that there is a unifying story, a single history, which encompasses all peoples and all times. This story, we add, is found in the Bible. It is the narrative of God acting for the salvation of fallen humankind and bringing creation to its goal, to its telos. Therefore, conflicting interpretations can be evaluated, we believe, according to a criterion which transcends them all, namely the story of God's action in Jesus of Nazareth, in whom the Word became flesh. We believe that the biblical narrative not only makes sense for us, we humbly are convinced that the message of God's saving work in Christ is also good news for all. It provides the fulfillment of the longings and aspirations of all peoples everywhere. It embodies the truth of and for all humankind. So as Christians, we must critique both positively and negatively what is going on around us. But as Christians, our primary goal and purpose is to communicate the ageless gospel to the Star Trek generation, to a culture that is increasingly postmodern in its thinking. And so the question still remains, how do we do this? That is to say, asking it as a theologian, what ought to be the shape of the gospel that we present in this context? Let me complete my discussion by offering a single response viewed from three related angles. First, we must communicate the gospel that fosters community. Now, you knew I was going to say that. One of the great gains of modernity has been the elevation of the individual. And so we dare not lose the emphasis on the importance of the individual human person, because this seemingly modern focus actually corresponds with certain central dimensions of scriptural teaching. While maintaining the individual focus of the gospel, however, we must shake ourselves loose from the radical individualism that has come to characterize the modern mindset. The Christian life, you see, is more than just Jesus and me for each tomorrow. Indeed, we must recapture the great biblical theme of fellowship, of community. At the foundation of our faith is the truth that God is the social Trinity. There is no other God but Father, Son, and Spirit who enjoy an eternal relationship. The goal of God's program in the world, in turn, is not the isolated, glorified saint living on a 100-acre ranch up in the sky. Rather, the triune God is at work in history, bringing about our participation in an eternal community. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. God is establishing a redeemed people who will live in a redeemed creation and enjoy the presence of the triune God. Our gospel, therefore, must put the human person back into the social and environmental context which forms and nourishes us. We must not merely speak of the individual in isolation, but must also speak of the human as person in relationship. Our understanding of humankind must take seriously the biblical truth that our identity includes being in relationship with creation, with others, with God, and as a consequence, in true relationship, even with ourselves. The focus on community, indicative of the postmodern world, calls us to recognize as well the importance of the community of faith, the Church of Jesus Christ, in our mission in proclaiming the gospel. You see, members of the next generation are often unimpressed by our verbal presentations. What they desire to see is a people who live out what they proclaim. A people among whom the Christian faith has fostered wholesome, authentic, loving, healing relationships. Indeed, following the example of Jesus and the apostles, at the heart of the gospel proclamation ought to be the invitation to become participants in the community of those whose highest loyalty is to the God revealed in Christ. Jesus' message wasn't, forgive me for saying this, God loves you and has a wonderful plan for your life, merely as an individual. That wonderful plan is life in relationship. He called his hearers to come and join, for follow me meant follow with. And our participation in the inviting community ought to draw others to Christ as we embody the gospel in the fellowship we share with each other. Postmodern people cry out, "We hear your words, Christians!" But what they're really asking is, does it work in their community? Dare I say, the clearest apologetic we have in the postmodern context is the presence of a compassionate, caring, loving community of Christ. By this shall all know that you are my disciples, if you have love. Second, we must communicate the gospel that embodies truth in all of its dimensions. A second significant gain of modernity has been the elevation of reason. The focus on logical argumentation, the scientific method, has freed us from a host of superstitions that plague pre-modern peoples.